The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? I'm your host, Soraya. And the interview you're going to hear tonight is with Walter Cruttenton. And Walter's been on the show before, but the thing about Walter is part of the reason this show exists. And I'll tell you how. For over 20 years, I've hosted a show called The Last Exit for the Lost. It airs after this on WVBR. So if you're listening live, you probably know all about it. And if you're listening to a podcast or whatever, you probably, may or may not have any knowledge of the show. It is primarily a heavy metal show, although we do a lot of other stuff like movie reviews and a lot of different underground styles of music. And for years, I have tried to incorporate a paranormal or fringe element to the show where we discuss different topics and never had any success doing it. Back in middle of 2012, my co-host Eric showed up, and we were able to successfully do that, which made me think, maybe I should start a second show devoted to this type of a topic. People really enjoyed it during The Last Exit for the Lost, but I wasn't confident enough to take on full-length interviews, the quality of which you hear here on Where Did the Road Go. I wasn't sure if I could do it or not, so I decided to see if I could get somebody to come on The Last Exit with me and have that conversation. I asked Walter. I was a big fan of his work. He seemed like a very personable guy, and I said, hey, Walter, would you come on my heavy metal show and talk to me about your book and your research? And he was more than happy to do it. It was a great interview. He had a blast. I had a blast. The listeners liked it. And you can actually find that if you go, it's on our Vimeo page, if nothing else. I believe it's in our blog if you go back far enough. But thanks to Walter, I had the confidence to actually try and start a show like this and hope that maybe I could handle it every week. So, I have Walter to thank for that, and he was gracious enough to come back on. He has his CPAC conference coming up next month, which I highly recommend you check out. Someday maybe we'll do a video feature from there. Speaking of video features, right now, if you go to our YouTube page, you can see a video interview with Lyle Blackburn. We caught up with him at the Power Horror Convention up in Buffalo, August 16th, I think it was. There's also one with Paranormal Expeditions, that's what it was. The interview with Lyle's fairly lengthy. We talk about cryptozoology in general, as well as, of course, the folk monster, Lizard Man, and Bigfoot overall. I was pretty happy with it. I thought it was interesting. The Paranormal Expeditions one is a little short, has some nice creepy stories in there, I guess. There's some other stuff I'm going to be uploading, including a very lengthy interview with Peter Robbins talking about his new book, which I will be putting up on the Where Did the Road Go page as well. It is available free from Phenomena Magazine, the entire thing. It's about, 400 pages or so. But most of it is documents and pictures, evidence that he presented, and much of which has never been compiled in one place like this. It is a massive, impressive piece of work that started out as a book review. So, you can check that out for free. The interview with Peter is pretty intense at times. You also get to see his pretty impressive book collection. And, that I hope to have up in the next week or so. And we're going to be doing some other ones with Peter in the future since he lives right nearby. Eventually, I hope to be able to expand out further to attend some other conventions, interview some other people in person, and get some more interesting video. Now, also, if you have some paranormal stories you want to share, unusual stories, whatever, get in touch. Go to the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com, message us on Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want to, whatever you're comfortable with. We can talk to you on either a podcast or on video if you're local. Also, if you want to help us out, there's a little donate button in the upper right. Help us pay for our server fees so that we can keep everything free, which is my intention. I do not intend to ever charge for any of this stuff. You can go back to the very first show we ever aired with Where Did the Road Go? You can download them all for free and hopefully share them. All right. With all that said, this is the interview from a couple weeks ago with Walter Cruttenton. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed doing it. Hey, Walter, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Soraya. Thanks for having me on.
And you're coming from almost halfway around the world at this point.
Yeah, I'm in Maui. You're in New York. That's a good third at least, I think. A quarter. 6 hours as the time goes.
Yeah. As almost as far away as we could be and still be in the same country.
You're right about that.
All right. So your work, what you're studying is... Well, you want to explain it to people a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I'm director of the Binary Research Institute, and that's where we look at the motion of the sky. It's called precession. And we're trying to figure out, you know, what causes it, because we think it has a slightly different cause than it says in the textbooks, and have some good evidence and proof to that effect. And so the Institute studies that problem and the implications of that motion and the cycle that it causes. And of course, we've written some books on this topic. My main book is Lost Star, Myth and Time. Another one is The Great Year Adventures with Tommy the Time Traveling Turtle. It's sort of a children's look at the topic, explaining the topic. And then you know, writing papers on it all the time, most of which can be accessed at the Binary Research Institute website.
And you also did a documentary on it called The Great Year, where you had James Earl Jones narrate.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. What an interesting man he is, too. You know, he stutters a little bit, and I guess it's happened since childhood, and so he's learned to talk in this beautiful, deep, manly voice as a way to kind of get around that. And of course, he's legendary for it. But still, he asked us to change a few words in the script just to, you know, accommodate the way they roll out of his mouth. And so we said, yes, Mr. Jones.
Oh, that's cool. And your book came out back in 2005, is that right?
Yeah, mid-2000s, and it's, you know, focuses on the ancient cultures that were aware of this sort of precessional motion, this cycle of the ages, if you will. And so I think we get into, you know, we must touch on 20 or 30 ancient cultures in that book, and then we, of course, talk about their view of the cycle, because... You know, it's not part of your modern scientific body of knowledge, and so it's kind of obscured through the historical record, although you do find a lot of mentions of it if you're looking for it. For example, in India, they call it the Yuga cycle, and they break it down into the Kali, Dwapara, Treta, and Satya Yuga. That would be their golden age. Versus in Greece, they call it, you know, the precession, the equinox, or one great year, and they break it into the same four ages, but of course the Greeks call them the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. And then, but the qualities they talk about are the same. And so here you have very disparate cultures, and it goes on. I mean, Polynesians, Egyptians, Mayans, Hopis, etc., talk about this. But they all kind of use this idea that the world goes through these different ages, and over a long period of time, mankind's you know, view of the world, the way he interacts with the world, goes through a complete metamorphosis. So it's a fun topic and something I'm trying to make my life's work.
Now, when it comes to the Yuga cycle, isn't there some debate over divine years versus the 24,000-year cycle?
Yeah, there is. And I think, you know, it's everything gets screwed up during the Dark Ages. It kind of, knowledge you know, ignorance takes over. And I mean, heck, look back just 500 years, 600 years before the Renaissance. Every country is at war with one another, and you know, there's no democracy or anything like that. There's no real good medicine. People die at half the age they live to now, and et cetera, et cetera. And same thing happened with knowledge. The great ancient wisdom was, you know, pillaged and plundered, and just really went by the wayside. And so this knowledge of the yugas, which used to be tied to the precession of the equinox, is now was extended to these super long periods of time, because they couldn't, you know, couldn't quite explain it, where it started and where it stops. And so there's a very good explanation of this in a book called The Holy Science by Swami Sri Yukteswar. He was the guru of Paramahansa Yogananda and quite a sage. And so he wrote back in 1894 that moons spin on their axis and go around planets. Planets with their moons go around their host star, the sun in our case. And then the moons, the planets, and the sun, of course, picks some star for its dual, and the whole solar system goes around it in a period of about 24,000 years, which is very close to what we measure precession at today. You know, it takes a little longer just because the orbit itself follows Kepler's laws, where it sort of speeds up and slows down. But if the ancient Indians had not lost, you know, sight of the astronomical motion that drives the yugas, I doubt that they would have, you know, come up with these really long periods of time, which don't make much sense. And let me add real quick, Soraya, that there is one other school there, and that is that there is an even longer cycle. You know, it's just as you have the cycle of day and night, because the Earth spins on its axis, and the cycle of seasons as the Earth goes around the sun, the cycle of the great year, our whole solar system going around its binary star. So too do some say that this whole system goes around, you know, the local stellar neighborhood, or maybe even the galaxy itself, in a pattern that does take millions of years, and that there really is a longer cycle. And this might have been confused with the precessional cycle. So.
Okay. All right. Because I've heard, you know, the other version, the long version, is the one you hear the most often, the divine year version. You'll hear people talk about it and say we're just, you know, entering the Kali Yuga, or just starting to come out the second half of the Kali Yuga. I forget what it is, and that it takes millions of years to make one cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in the long cycle, if you want to look at that, there's just so little knowledge and astronomical evidence, you know, because the motions would be so tiny, it would take so long to actually observe it, that we don't have much knowledge. But the stuff I hear about says that it bottomed out about 3000 BC, so we're definitely in the Kali Yuga of the long cycle, although slightly on an incline. That kind of shows up a little bit in evolution. And the shorter cycle, which is much more pronounced, although still nothing compared to the seasons of the year, actually bottomed out about 500 AD, the depths of the Dark Ages, you know, with the fall of Rome, and virtually all the great civilizations had fallen by that time: Mesopotamia, Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, the whole Indus Valley, Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, you know. They had indoor plumbing and sewer systems and built with uniform building products. And by the time of the Dark Ages, it was, you know, mud huts and nomads moving around.
And you could say the same thing about South America and Central America, couldn't you? Because it looks like there was a high culture there, too, that descended down.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. You see some of the few remaining items from long, long ago, Caral, Peru, with its alignments, or some of these massive block walls where they don't know how they they put in these 5, 6, sometimes even 9-sided blocks to where you can't put a piece of paper in between the crack. And, you know, somehow they were able to build in a ways that obviously were completely lost by the time Spanish had gotten there.
Right, and it just descended into a very primitive type of culture.
Yeah. Matter of fact, the whole Mayan culture kind of came apart in a pretty gruesome way. You know, in Europe, when they were having inquisitions and plagues and torture came to become a fine science, the same thing pretty much was going on in the West, where, you know, there were some, you know, pretty bad things going on in the way that people would be treated. So, yeah, the Dark Ages were so profound, and there was so much plunder and pillage going on that a lot of evidence of the higher ages was wiped out. And so today we have very little knowledge of the higher ages. We consider it just to be myth and folklore. And but there are, you know, a lot of these archaeological findings that people are coming across, as we just talked about, you know, in South America and in India and Mesopotamia, et cetera, Corral, Peru, to Göbekli Tepe, Turkey. You know, they're finding this evidence of stuff that shouldn't have existed in a hunter-gatherer age, if you will. And so I think more and more people are taking this seriously, and that's good.
Yeah. All right. And so you're tying the cycle of dark and ages and stuff such into precession of the equinox. The driving factor there would be what?
Okay. So the precession of the equinox is simply something that you observe. So just as the Earth spins on its axis, and we happen to observe the sun and all the stars rise in the east and set in the west every day, it's just a sign that our Earth must be spinning because all the stars are going around us. And likewise, the annual cycle can be seen in the stars. So the Earth goes around the sun. It takes 365.2422 days. And during that period of time, roughly, you know, one of the 12 ancient constellations will be overhead, those that are along the ecliptic, Pisces, Taurus, Aquarius, et cetera, et cetera. And will be roughly overhead, you know, at the zenith at midnight, roughly once a month or so. So you can kind of see that there's, that the Earth is doing something on an annual basis just by looking at the changing position of the stars. And if you watch them carefully, you'll notice that it gets back to the same point, you know, each year. Except that it really doesn't. If you measure really, really close, it actually comes up about 50 arc seconds short of the same point relative to the fixed stars. And
that would take a very advanced science to even know to look for that.
You're right. And yet a lot of cultures seem to have been aware of it, and they kind of broke it down to simple terms, you know, and they would say, they'd call it the precession of the equinox. So if you look at the equinox, or just on that day, you know, the day that night and day are of equal length, the sun is setting at a specific point on the horizon exactly between the two solstice points, the dead of winter and the dead of summer, you would notice that, you know, the alignment with the stars is just moving just slightly. And so they, you know, that 60 songs, the dawning of the age of Aquarius, that's really sort of ancient information that, you know, the equinox was in Aries for roughly 2,000 years, and then it was in Pisces for roughly 2,000 years, and that's a still where we are right now at the end of Pisces, and we're just coming up to the beginning of the age of Aquarius, and that's if you use the vernal equinox, the spring equinox. And so it is observable, but you're right, it takes a very long period of time to notice it, you know, because it's only moving 50 arc seconds per year, which is roughly 1 degree every 72, 73 years at the current rate.
Okay. And the official explanation of why that is?
The official explanation really started with Newton. So, you know, Copernicus, he's the one that sort of changed to a heliocentric system from a geocentric system, because, you know, the heliocentric system was lost with the ancient Greeks, and the geocentric system then sort of dominated during the Dark Ages. But Copernicus could explain the first two motions of the Earth, why it spins on its axis and why it, you know, goes around the sun, but he had a difficult time explaining the third one, so he called it libration or wobble. And so Newton came along, you know, a couple hundred years later and said, okay, if the Earth wobbles, it has to be due to the gravity, which he had just sort of codified, of the sun and the moon, the two biggest, closest masses to us, tugging on the Earth and therefore causing the axis to wobble. And sure enough, you know, if you look at the Earth's orientation relative to fixed stars, you see it moving 50 arc seconds per year, and the axis does librate a little bit relative to the moon, you know. So if, when the moon goes around the Earth, when it's above the equator, it will pull the northern hemisphere slightly towards it, and when it's below the equator, it'll pull the southern hemisphere slightly towards it. And,
right.
And so that wobble takes place, although that is actually a different cycle. It's 18.6 years, but it kind of got all lost in the wash, and nobody studies celestial mechanics anymore. It's considered a pretty old science. It's considered to be all figured out, and people have gone on to, you know, plasma physics and black holes and Big Bang theory, stuff like that.
Right.
A lot more fun.
And so your suggestion is that the ancients had a different explanation for precession.
Yeah, so they tied it to this cycle, and many of them made reference to, it having some stellar cause. And then it really was Sri Yukteswar who pointed out that Oriental astronomy is very plain. Ancient Oriental astronomy says you have the precession of the equinox because the sun goes around another star. And, of course,
right. They
never told us what star, and Tristor never pointed it out either. So, but we've done, you know, exhaustive studies to look at the current explanations of precession, and it's just, the theory is just full of holes that they just keep changing and updating, you know, because it used to be that the Earth changed orientation of the fixed stars at, you know, 50.5 seconds per year. Then it was 50.4 seconds per year. Now it's 50.3 seconds per year, moving to 50.29. You know, as our instruments get better, we realize, oh, man, this thing's changing all the time. And so the theories that they had saying, well, it's got to be this amount of mass tugging on us, they've added in all these other things to try to correct for it. And they said, okay, well, maybe it's not just the sun and the moon. It's the nearby other planets. It's asteroids coming by. It's tectonic plates moving. It's earthquakes. It's tidal forces. And so they've put in almost 4,000 components now. So the equation is so complex, few people bother to study it. But we do, and we notice that they cannot predict it right without continually adding things to sort of make up for it. And then they say, well, that fixes it. You know, they did this in 1940, 1950, 1960, 1970, 1980. They say that fixes it once and for all. They just did it again in 2000, 2003, 2006. And we've come along and said, well, let's just say for a moment that the ancients are right, that the solar system moves in a orbit that follows Kepler's laws. That means it speeds up and it slows down. You know, anything speeds up as it gets closer to the other mass, slows down as it goes farther away from it. We passed the low point of the dark ages, so we're speeding up. We're moving slightly towards the other star at this point, although still very far from it. And therefore, the precession rate would be appear to get shorter and shorter each year, 50.5, 50.4, 50.3. So we did all the math there. And we only have, you know, Kepler's laws and maybe six variables versus the current precession theory out there is just a jumble of equations with these 4,000 things and never work. And ours is 43 times more accurate had you used it any time over the last couple hundred years in predicting the changing rate of precession.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just absolutely case closed. There is no question that precession is caused by motion of the solar system, not these local forces. And I would say that, you know, that nutation and Chandler's wobble, all these short duration things are caused by the local forces, but not what we call precession.
Now, haven't they tried to study the degree of precession relative to, like, Venus and certain asteroids and found out that there isn't any?
You know, it's a tricky thing because we look at it from Earth, and the assumptions of the Earth are that the Earth is wobbling at such and such a rate. And so theoretically, you could do it, you know, putting something on the object of that body and looking. But, you know, there's a few cracks in the theory that give me some hope that people are going to discover kind of what's going on. I mean, I've got some scientists, astronomers that I'm talking to that are just cheering us on and saying, you know, press the case. But there's something people are talking about more and more nowadays, and that's precession of the orbits, or, you know, the planetary paths that all the planets follow.
Uh-huh.
So people are starting to realize, ooh, in addition to the Earth wobbling, all the paths of all the planets seem to be also precessing. And so when you throw that into the existing equation, although the two sides aren't talking to each other too much yet, you do actually come up with a very close approximation, because one's at roughly 26,000, one's at 22,000, we're at 24,000. And so I'm hopeful, and we're probably getting way too technical for the mass of the public, but I just want you to know there's really rock-solid science behind this, and we have papers on our site to prove it.
Now, as we look more and more out into space with more detailed instruments, what percentage of the stars we see out there have binary or more companions?
Oh, it's a huge number, and great question, by the way. Because, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we thought, ooh, a companion star, that must be really rare. You know, and by 50 years ago, they were thinking, oh, my gosh, astronomy is so good, they realized over half the stars are in binary or multiple star systems. And the latest estimates, now that they're finding brown dwarfs, you know, a little difficult-to-see stars, it's about 80%. So we become the anomaly. You know, why wouldn't our own sun have a companion?
Right, and I guess the biggest question people are probably asking is, if there's a binary companion, where would it be? Why don't we see it?
Yeah. No, it used to be that, virtually all the astronomers and astrophysicists that I talked to said, well, if there is one, we'd know it by now. Our instruments are so darn good. And so case closed. And just in the last 10 years or so, they're starting to realize that the solar system isn't quite as neat and tidy as they thought it was. And this really started, with Muller at UC Berkeley, who proposed that there must be some sort of a companion star out there to cause these catastrophic effects now and then. Mike Brown at Caltech has really pushed the ball forward because, he's found all these massive Kuiper Belt objects, which they call dwarf planets. As a matter of fact, he's the guy that's blamed with killing Pluto.
Very unpopular thing.
Yeah. His book is called How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming or something like that.
Yeah.
But they found, a bunch of planetoids that are of very similar size and much more distance. And what's very interesting is they're at such oddball orbits and inclines to our current planetary plane that it shows that they're really not that affected by the sun. They're affected by something else. And so two Spanish scientists have just come out and said, there must be not only one very massive object out there, but two. And these are mainstream guys, too. So we've, at least since I published the book, we've gone from the point of there can't be anything out there, you're crazy, to a whole bunch of astronomers and astrophysicists looking for things that are at least 10 times the mass of Earth. And so we're moving in the right direction.
Okay. Now, a lot of ancient cultures talk about another sun. One of the things you mentioned in the book is Copernicus talking about a central fire.
Yeah. So we find these references, and they're kind of vague, but they do seem to talk more about the effects of this motion, that there is a cycle. And so that type of effect, the fact that there was, the Greeks are talking about a golden age of long ago and how sweet it was and the earth gave of itself freely. And Hesiod, wrote beautiful things about this. And of course, because we were not aware of the cycle, we call him a poet instead of a historian, but the Greeks considered him in their own time as a historian. You do find references to it. Also, some of the Mesopotamian texts, there's a brilliant Assyrianologist, Stefan Mall, German, won the Leibniz Prize. He can read cuneiform texts better than anybody in the world, although he will say even he can barely understand 5 or 10% of this stuff.
Wow.
But he really points to the fact about how they're often making reference to a long ago higher age. It's somehow stellar induced, and they realize they're sort of declining, and they were dead right, because you go from Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, and these great cities, and they too had underground sewer systems and massive waterworks and beautiful ziggurats and hanging gardens and just unbelievable stuff. And, they end up as nomads by the Dark Ages themselves.
Yeah.
It happened everywhere.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Walter Cruttenton.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's Where Did the Road Go? Facebook.com.
And we're talking tonight with Walter Crutton, author of Lost Star, Myth and Time. And you have a conference coming up here in October.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, see, people don't just have to hear about me in this theory. There's a whole bunch of people that are great scientists that are starting to write about it. And Robert Schock will be at the conference again. He's, you know, famed for not only redating the Sphinx, but also for his work with Göbekli Tepe, and that's a that's a great, fascinating story. And then Dean Radin, you know, author of Conscious Universe, Supernormal. He's been looking more and more at ancient cultures, and actually going to be talking about one ancient Indian text and how they sort of talked about, you know, higher age powers, if you will, and how this is sort of being rediscovered through the science of yoga. So he's trying to tie the ancient teachings to the modern world to some degree. And, you know, Laird Scranton does the same thing, but he's looking more at ancient languages and finding the similarities and finding out how truly advanced they are in their earliest symbols. And then they kind of get to be, you know, structures and scrawls that people hardly understand anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, hope we got some great speakers talking about it. It's October 17th to 19th. It's called the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, and it'll be in Rancho Mirage at the Westin Hotel. The website is cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com.
And that's out in California for anyone who doesn't know.
Yeah.
And one of the things you're going to be talking about is these straight roads that have been redated. Do you want to talk a little about that? Tell people what these are?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to try to tie that thought, this some of the archaeological findings that are being made, to the solar system discoveries, all these dwarf planets that lead us to believe you know, there's got to be something very big out there that's causing the whole solar system to curve through space. And so that's kind of the overview. These straight roads, I don't know that any traditional archaeologist or even any alternative archaeologist has a good explanation at this time. We find them, and I know when the Brits, you know, found them, they used them. And so, for example, what's their main road there going through Britain? I think they call it A6 or something like that.
Ah, okay.
They, you know, they built that on top of an old road, and, of course, the British Engineering Services took credit for it and said, you know, it goes back a few hundred years. And then they were called out on that by some archaeologists in the 1900s and said, no, these go back to Roman times. And the latest discovery, just in the last really year or two, is that no. If you look under what you call Roman roads, you find Neolithic, Mesolithic settlements, and they're right along this road, so what we call a road, and so they go back probably 6,000 years, you know, three times the length of the Romans. So this is how sort of modern history is. As we discover more, our tools get better, our science gets better, we continually kind of get more reflective and redate things. And, you know, that's what Robert Schock's doing. That's what a lot of other people are doing out there, just pointing out the fact that things are much older than we thought they were. And so here, even in the U.S., you know, you find some of these roads. And one in Chaco Canyon, you know, these perfectly straight roads. They go straight into a cliff, and then at the top of a several hundred high foot cliff, they continue straight on again, which tells you they weren't used for driving. They were used for something else. Yeah.
Yeah, that's puzzling.
Yeah, isn't it?
I think, too, you mentioned Göbekli Tepe. That's kind of been a game changer for archaeology, seeing something so advanced that's so old.
I love it, yeah. And especially justification for Shock, you know, because Shock really took some arrows in his back for, you know, just offering the suggestion that the Sphinx has got to be older than the 4,400 years or whatever they traditionally put it at. And he says, you know, this limestone, I know it well. You can look elsewhere. It just doesn't weather this quickly. It's got to be at least twice the age. And he was kind of conservative. And they all laughed at him. The geologist didn't, by the way. I heard him speak at the Geological Society in 2002, and he was, you know, they all support him. But the archaeologists who had their pat story, it just, you know, it messed up their story. So they said, no, unless you can find something a whole lot older that kind of led to it, you know, to keep with their theory of evolution, that it can't be. You got to be a crackpot. And so, almost 20 years go by, and then finally they discover Göbekli Tepe, and it's just this beautiful structure that itself would have been completely wiped off the planet had it not been purposely buried 8 to 10,000 years ago. It gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
And why was it buried? Like, what happened to these people who built it?
Good question. Great question. You know, Shock and a few others think it might be to save it from a pending cataclysm, you know, something asteroid, comet,
right.
Something outward.
Solar.
Yeah, but if you read some of these, some of Stefan Mall's work and their interpretation in the, in these cuneiform tablets, it looks like they're well aware that we're going into a pretty heavy dark age of dark ages here. You know, the universal cycles lining up, the precession cycles lining up, and it's going to be bad. And so it could well be that they just knew that so much knowledge would be wiped out and that Göbekli Tepe itself is some kind of an instrument, and they wanted to preserve it somehow. So I'm not sure, but it's incredible. You know, it's not a primitive structure. It's not built like a square or a rectangle or even an igloo. And these T-shaped pillars are not just to lie boards on top, you know, because you would put them in different alignments for that. And they seem to all have, you know, these bas-reliefs of constellations, different star groups. And they point at different places in the sky. It's amazing.
Andrew Collins, I think, has done a good job about proving that these T-shaped pillars actually represented people.
It could well be, and I would just modify that slightly to say maybe gods.
Yes.
Because they associate the stars with gods, each star being a god, you know. And each wandering star, each planet, you know, of course, is named Mars or Jupiter. It actually has a god's name to this day.
Right.
And so, I do think there's something related to that, but it's not just, I don't think it's as simplistic as our understanding is capable of at this point. I think it's something we'll probably need to be more evolved ourselves to truly understand.
It's an interesting way of looking at it. Let's talk a little about Cataclysm. If there is a companion star, could it be creating catastrophic events, bringing asteroids, you know, knocking asteroids out of orbit and such as it gets closer?
It very well could, and that's something that you know, we mentioned as sort of a remote possibility in our film, The Great Year, where we show a graphic of how two stars getting closer to each other the one might disturb our Kuiper belt, which seems to have a very sheer edge to it. And so there's some evidence for that, and that's what Dr. Mueller's work, Richard Mueller at UC Berkeley, is kind of all about, that, you know, you have these clear extinction events that you find in the geological record, and he believes that, you know, there's something that causes those. Although he's kind of at a much longer period of time than just the simple precession cycle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it seems like the last major event would have been at the end of the last ice age, which would have been almost at the peak of the golden age.
Yes, you know, there is a very high correlation between the periodicity of the ice ages and the precession periodicity. I mean, it's almost perfect. It's roughly, you know, 22 to 26,000 years, and precession's 24,000 years. So there does seem to be something to that effect.
One of the possibilities of a binary companion for our sun is the star Sirius, a visible star in the sky.
That's correct, yeah. And I've, the more I read, the more I lean towards that, and it was probably my last choice at the very beginning when I started this work. But there's just some terrific body of work, mostly by the Homans out of Canada, that suggests that, you know, Sirius just doesn't move like other stars.
And it doesn't seem to precess, correct?
Yeah, and it's not just them noticing this in modern times. It's scholars throughout the ages who have kind of brought this up. And so astronomers kind of scrambled to come up with reasons for this. But there's this Jed Buchwald, he's out of Caltech, who's written on it, and that's probably the best source for people that want to do a little more study on that topic.
So what is the official explanation?
For
why Sirius doesn't seem to precess?
I would say that most people do not believe that yet.
Ah, okay.
But they don't do studies of it either. Only the Homans have done a study, as far as I know. But people do notice it. They notice that, Sirius stays very close to the sun. So we need, you know, more scholars to start to take this work seriously and actually do a study, but it, you know, takes a long period of time and some transit equipment.
And wasn't there some aberration when Sirius B transits in front of Sirius A?
Yes, yeah. The Homans found, because they started this work, you know, early 80s, and then that was roughly 1989-90, and it was, because it happens, you know, roughly every 50 years or so. And sure enough, there was the whole Earth seemed to slow down in its rotation by about a second a day. And then once we passed, it sped up by about a second a day and kind of got back on its same thing. So it looks like there's some kind of a gravitational effect, which you wouldn't expect, you know, given the distance to Sirius. It's put at roughly, I think, 8.6 light years, although the center of mass would be much closer, you know,
right,
6 light years or something. But the way Homan explained it, you know, that gravity can work at a distance, and it's like trying to get a big bowl of water moving. You know, let's say you've got a 2-foot diameter bowl and you're trying to get that water to swish around. At first, it's kind of hard and bumpy, but once you get it going, then it takes just the slightest movement with your baby finger to keep this thing going. And so they believe there's, you know, gravitational waves that have their effect across space, and so I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, I know you're also not big on the electric universe theory, but when I had Wallace Thornhill on, I did ask him if in their model, if a star like Sirius could be connected at that distance to our sun, and he immediately said yes. He doesn't believe it is, but he said that under their system, it would totally be possible to have a connection at that distance.
Yeah, and then you find some myth and folklore, too, that points to a strong connection. Obviously, the ancient Egypts, to them, it was their most important star, Isis. And Isis is always seen cradling, you know, Ra, the sun, or one of the different names for the sun. And so it's Hathor primarily, but it's yeah, there's a real strong connection you find elsewhere. And I wouldn't say I'm negative on the electronic universe theory. I haven't studied enough to really understand but I think there's some very compelling factors to it, and it fits with you know, the work that stars sort of communicate at long distances. Who was the guy who won the Nobel Prize in 1970 for that observation?
I don't know.
Yeah, I can't recall off the top of my head.
Well, I know the electric universe advocates say that electricity is more powerful than gravity, and that a lot of what we see as gravitational effects may be electrical in nature.
Yeah, and that actually fits well with what some of the these great, you know, ancient bodies of knowledge talk about as interpreted by more modern sages like Sri Yukteswar. He actually calls this cycle, this processional cycle, he calls it an electrical couple. As you move towards the star, you know, we're in this ascending cycle. There's this increasing attraction. And then as you move away, you know, things kind of get goofed up and there's reception isn't as good. And, you know, people are just mentally befuddled.
And you were giving me an analogy earlier about something like that, about like cell phone signals breaking up.
Yeah, John Darian, this physicist with CERA, he's got a pretty little analogy he uses where there's a car on a racetrack, and it's a big racetrack, and at one end it goes near a mountain where there's a radio tower, and the person in the car gets great radio reception. And at the other end of the track, miles away, you know, they get very poor reception. And he says that's kind of what the binary system is like. You know, we go to a point that it almost acts like the sun. You know, when we're the Earth's at a certain angle to the sun, plants grow really nicely. And when that angle is too low, there's just not enough sunlight for things to work very well. And he says there's other things going on a scale we can't even understand, but it works like that. But it's not just a track and a radio tower. There's rocks and signals bouncing off things. And he said, that would be astrology.
All right.
Yeah.
So if we are in this binary system, and why would that be causing light and dark ages? Like, why would that be having such an effect on us?
Well, the best hypothesis I've heard is the work of Valerie Hunt at UCLA. She's this physiologist who, you know, studied the effects of electromagnetic waves on people, and she would put them in the what they call the Mu room at UCLA, which is a Faraday cage, where they're completely isolated from sort of the natural ambiance, the electrical magnetic effects that we live in right now. And when people are cut off from it, they would get very sad have a rough time, almost like depression. And then, you know, there's other things she showed. If you increase negative ions, which you get around the seashore with breaking waves and waterfalls, and, you know, you get it a lot in nature, people are naturally happier. And so I don't know exactly how it works, Soraya, but I think that's an analogy. Something's going on in the background as we get closer to or farther from other stars or other points in space. There are environmental effects that happen.
Now, Sirius already has a binary companion. How does that work if we're connected to Sirius?
So Sirius B goes around Sirius A roughly every 50 years, as we were just discussing, and it. But it doesn't mean that we couldn't also be going around that system, but obviously in a much longer period of time, roughly 24,000 years. And indeed, we find binary systems out there with very disparate orbits. We don't find too many of the long ones just because it takes such a darn long time to observe them.
Right.
But the longer we observe other systems, the more we're realizing there's very long-term things going around them. And so, but we do think that Sirius B's motion around A affects it. It's a neutron star. It's the only one in our local stellar neighborhood. And it's massive, and it seems to be sort of pulling some of these dwarf planets. If you look at the periodicities of Pluto, it's exactly 10 to 1, Sirius B's ratio. And these are resonances or harmonics that, you know, astrophysicists study, just beginning to study, really. But, you know, you would have chaotic systems if planets and stars did fall into patterns over periods of time.
Right.
And so everything kind of falls into a resonance. And indeed, you're finding more and more of these dwarf planets seem to be right in sync with a precessional resonance. And it's something, you know, we've noticed and commented on because we're looking for it. But I haven't seen anything in the mainstream literature yet other than they point out the periodicities of the dwarf stars, and they are, in fact, in these neat little ratios to the great year.
Okay. And there was a project called Gravity Probe B.
Right. Yeah.
And that seemed to be very frustrating to you.
Yeah. I mean, we think it absolutely proved out what we were looking for. So I'd written.
What did it do?
Okay. It gets really complicated, but it's basically a probe sent up to get away from the Earth's precession, and it had the finest gyros ever built, and so it was going to test for Einstein's theory to see if the mass of the Earth actually did bend time and space. And so I saw that, and I said, aha, so they think they're getting beyond precession. If the precession is solely due to the Earth wobbling, then, in fact, they get off the wobbling Earth, they are going to find something like this. They get far enough out. But I said, you know, our theory is precession isn't just the Earth wobbling, it's the whole solar system moving.
Right.
Yeah, and so I wrote them a year before the results were out and said, the experiment was still ongoing. I said, hey, you're going to find some really screwy information. You aren't going to know how to explain it, but it's going to show that, you know, there's some precessionary forces acting on your computer. That'll be sort of be the net effect. And so, you know, a year goes by. They get these findings in. They don't never release stuff, you know, the full stuff to the public. But they call me up. Hey, Walter, real nonchalant. Do you mind visiting? You know, let's talk about this. We'd like to give you a tour anyway because you've expressed interest in Gravity Probe B. So I get there. They have their six top guys around a table and say, where are you coming from on this? Why did you write that? And so they start to look at it seriously. They said, whoa, what if there is some big black hole nearby? You know, because, of course, they don't see anything. They assume there can't be any binary star. And that was kind of where they got to. And then so they spent months, another probably 2 years after that, trying to filter out what they called noise. so they could prove Einstein's theory, because otherwise they're going to have big egg on their face. I mean, this thing is a couple $100 million, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened. And finally NASA comes out and says the experiment was a failure. NASA gave it an F. There's an article out on that. And, of course, the people at Stanford and Gravity Probe B went out and got some private funding by some Arab, I think it was like an extra $500,000 or something, to kind of save face and say, no, we cleaned up the noise, and in fact we did prove that Einstein was correct. Case closed. That's it.
did they ever release that information?
You can get some of it because, you know, NASA part is part of the public record. But it's mostly raw data, and so without actually having some members of the team and how to filter all that and look at all that, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think people look back at it 10 or 20 years from now and say, obviously. Yeah.
You think it'll only take 10 or 20 years before this theory gains more momentum?
Oh, yeah. And it's because, you know, these Spanish astronomers that just came out, you know, they're looking for massive stuff out there. And other people are realizing these dwarf planets can't be in the position they are without something big affecting it. So there's really some serious people starting to look at what's going on with our solar system.
Back in 2002, you went to see Tom Van Flandren, and you mentioned that the eclipse cycles you were studying don't fit with current theory.
With current precession theory, right.
Okay.
And that was actually some of the Homans' work that first discovered that. But, you know, it's a bit complicated because they correct for it. Regardless of the cause of precession, they correct for it.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So whether the eclipse cycle's not working quite right, is that what's going on?
No, the eclipse cycles work right, but you cannot have it. It's not due to a wobbling Earth. The
okay.
Earth changing position in its orbital plane, the way they currently explain precession. You know, that you would actually lose 50 arc seconds per year, and so you'd end up at a completely different point in the orbital plane. And so it's a little bit dense, but but I think it's one of these things that people look back on again and say, you know, there's basically evidence everywhere all around us when you look for it.
Yeah, and as well as the speed, there was a Australian scientist who calculated the speed of the solar system, or tried to, which matches up with your calculations, right?
Yeah, Reg Cahill out of Flinders University or something in South Australia, and he's we came up with, you know, the solar system had to be moving 430 kilometers a second because that's how long it would take on average to get around the center of mass with a star like Sirius, and didn't ever expect to, you know, anything to come of that, because that's, you know, that's above current estimates, although, you know, current estimates are always relative to what, because everything's moving out there, right?
Right.
And so he came up with this sort of novel idea, let's measure the speed of the solar system relative to the CMB, the cosmic microwave background. And sure enough, when he measures relative to that, he came up with exactly 430 kilometers a second. So
that's awesome.
All right, well, we're just about out of time, Walter. Do you want to tell people again about the CPAC conference coming up in October?
Okay, it's please everyone join us at the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. Just go to cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com. And you can learn a lot more about this topic from people that are much smarter than I am.
And that is October 17th to 19th at Rancho Mirage in California.
That's correct, yeah.
And your website is thebinaryresearchinstitute.com?
It's .org.
.org. Okay.
Yeah, good articles on there, including some of the proofs we were talking about.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us again, Walter.
Thank you, Soraya. I love what you're doing. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
All right, and we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. And if you want to know more about Psyche Corporation, it's spelled P-S-Y-C-H-E Corporation. And you can find a whole bunch of stuff at psychecorporation.com. This is Worrying World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that bugs my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. Of the universe, ventricles and atria, chambers number 1597, and counting. Can you?